ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option. It's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Belle, why are you standing there with a placard? What do you want?
The science show.
And when do you want it?
Now!
And you can have this science show with stars such as Professor Jessica Dempsey, who brought us the first picture of a black hole and has just been announced as director of the Great Square Kilometre Array. But I'm not sure about now. It's the concept of now. It may not exist. And later in the science show, a Welsh scientist and philosopher, that deadly combination, Professor Geraint Lewis, tells us now may be really suspect. Such is reality.
Oh gosh, it's too early for these kinds of conversations, Robin. Well, I'm Belinda Smith and I am real.
And I'm Robin Williams, known in Wales as No Good Boyle, and that's negotiable. But do meet Professor Jessica Dempsey, new director of what could be the biggest scientific experiment ever, the Square Kilometre Array. And she's been to the South Pole and she studied drama and theatre before physics. Professor, how come? Explain theatre and film.
Oh, I was going to be the next Cate Blanchett. That was the plan. And my mother was worried I would starve, so I did a science degree as well to reassure her. And halfway through, I just got enamoured of the whole thing and playing with building telescopes, this idea. And then someone offered me, I think I was 19, would you like to come with us down to Antarctica and be the first Australian female scientist to work at the South Pole? And I thought, well, I haven't seen snow before. That sounds cool. Let's go.
And how did it turn out, apart from very cold?
Well, I only got my tongue stuck to the telescope once, so, you know, I can be taught. But it was an extraordinary experience. And just, you know, the awe of being in a different kind of desert. It's anywhere near as dry as where, you know, I grew up out bush south of Darwin. But miraculously beautiful, and it turns out one of the best places to look at the universe.
How come? Because aren't there clouds?
No. I mean, when you go into the interior to the South Pole Station and above, you're on 3 kilometres of ice sheet. So you're actually very high, and it's dry. So especially for sub-millimetre astronomy, which you don't really care about light in the way, you care about how much water is in the atmosphere. So you have to go to the driest places on the planet, of which Antarctica is one.
Yeah, people don't realise that because, as you say, 3 kilometres of ice there. And so the weather was kind to you, was it?
Not at all. I mean, a warm day at South Pole in the summer is probably minus 20. In the winter, and I did do a winter over after I finished my PhD, and I think we hit minus 82 was our record. But it'll go below minus 70 for, you know, half of that winter.
And what were you doing there? Looking up and doing astronomy in a straightforward way?
Very straightforward. In fact, what we were doing was looking for some of the cosmic microwave background signal. In fact, I stared at the same 5 pieces of sky with my telescope for 13 months. And in the last 2 sort of bumps in the signal, if you like, the shape of the cosmic microwave are mine. And they asked me after my winter to come back to Berkeley to do a postdoc to reduce all the data. I said, thank you, but no thank you. I never want to see another cosmic microwave background signal as long as I live. It's a very patient scientist. I'm an instant gratification kind of astronomer.
An echo of the Big Bang.
Yeah, that's right.
And I was talking to Brian Schmidt, just to drop another name. He got a Nobel Prize for dark energy. Yeah. In other words, that the expansion of the universe is speeding up. And then there was a question of doubt. But is there still conjecture about whether the cosmic background radiation, in other words, the echo, and also those gigantic sources of light, which you can trace how distant they are and how more distant they're becoming, is this now a quandary?
It is a quandary, and this is one of the reasons that I just love astronomy and science. We're at this place called the Hubble tension, where these two different methods of measuring the same thing give us different answers. And so we still have a very big question mark over how the universe began and how it formed. And that's why we're still in the game. I mean, if we knew all of the answers, it'd be done and dusted. And I think it's always so interesting. This is usually when you open up a whole new window on the universe, when you suddenly can't crack this nut. And I think that right here, that's the reason this next generation of telescopes is so important.
Yeah. Now, the SKA, the Square Kilometre Array, of course, we're referring to the WA, the West Australian part. Are you also officer commanding the South African part?
I am the officer commanding the whole thing, for my sins. And so, yes, we decided to do this twice at the same time. And now for me, backwards and in heels. So, yeah, we are doing two because it is with the combination of the two that we really open up this discovery engine, which is what I call the SKA.
Well, the Murchison is more or less ready, but the array of hundreds of antennae, all of that is yet to be finished. When is the SKA actually ready to go?
I knew you were going to ask me that. So, well, the good news about the way you build radio telescopes is it's ready now. I mean, we have collected the first image with the SKA LOWE, and we can continue to do that. So the telescope will only continue to become more powerful. 131,000 of these antennas, that's going to take us a little bit longer. So we're very much hoping that in the early 2030s, we'll have finished that entire array, which will span 74 kilometres of the Murchison. And that's when we're really going to get cracking on some of these really important science questions.
And the questions are coming through with a deluge of information like almost nothing ever before in human history. Now, this is where AI for once justifies its existence, crunching those numbers and putting it together. How do you regard that?
It is the existential question for this telescope. We don't have a moving telescope. People look at it and go, well, where's the dish? It's like, well, the dish is digital. We're building this dish essentially in the air above the antenna, and all of that takes up digital room. And that digital real estate, we're coming in at hundreds of terabytes per second. And then you have to make a whole bunch of choices really quickly to make sure you've got the signal in a way that you can handle before you drown in that data. And that's really the technology hurdle that we have to overcome. And yes, AI will be our best friend as we try and wrestle with the enormous data question that we're trying to answer.
Such as the sort of thing that Brian Schmidt was on about, the way in which the universe may or perhaps may not be expanding, and what that tells you about its origins, and what next?
And I think one of the most interesting questions that we're chasing, especially with the part of the telescope in Western Australia, of course, in radio astronomy, hydrogen is our friend. This was the 21-centimetre long signal that, of course, our beloved Parkes, along with all of those first radio telescopes, found, and we mapped hydrogen. We thought maybe that's radio astronomy done. But of course, if you go way back to some of the first hydrogen, that's actually what we're trying to chase with the SKA. So this is what we call the cosmic dawn. And this is an era when, after the noise of the Big Bang happened and our first stars started to form and started to re-ionize. So this was the first time hydrogen, brand new hydrogen, was used in anger. And that's the signal we're chasing, because it's so, so much more distant that this signal is at very, very low frequency and it's very, very faint. And in the equivalent of the Nobel hunting territory, finding this signal of cosmic dawn, that might be where these questions that right now we can't resolve start to be answered.
Will you know where hydrogen came from? In other words, in the nucleus, one proton and outside one electron? Pretty simple.
It should be, right? And it should be pretty simple to find this signal. And there's been many telescopes already built to find it. And I think what we've said, because we have a lovely set of non-detections, that's all I explain to people. That means we know with very high precision where it isn't. And so that's actually important. It doesn't sound important, but it is. So we very much need more antennas. Scientific greed is the only thing that's going to overcome how faint this signal is. And we need roughly about 131,000 of them if we're going to hope to find this signal.
So when you turn up on day one, or have you been there already, what will you be doing?
Well, I have. I'm now 2 months into the job. And I think, you know, it's a bit like herding cats through a shower, is just trying to keep all of the pieces together. I mean, the extraordinary scale of what we're doing is the daunting thing. We have 16 member countries and an international governmental organization who are putting this together. But when you stand out there in the Murchison now and you just see antenna pieces stacked up like a glitch in the Matrix, that's the first time I went, oh, hang on, we're doing something unprecedented. The scale of what we're doing is the extraordinary bit. So I think it's my job to try and keep calm and carry on and make sure that, you know, everyone's still in one piece at the end of this.
And how will you keep the public informed? Obviously, we have, via the Science Show and various all sorts of other programs, a huge public interest in what next and some of the discoveries.
The thing is, and as I mentioned, I'm the instant gratification astronomer. And one of the things which we're finding is transient universe in the radio, the things that literally go bang in the night. And the radio discoveries that will be coming out within the next few years, I can promise you, we don't know what they are yet, but they're out there. So these fast radio bursts, what are they? I really hope we scoop the extremely large telescope, which of course is being built right now in Chile. And we very possibly could find the first Earth-like planet with SKA Low.
And that'll be interesting.
So watch the space. And I think the thing I would say is that in terms of keeping people informed, science isn't finished until it's communicated. And we need to have a better and more closely connected a way of talking with our community because, and especially radio astronomy, it's sort of a bit harder to get your head around. So it's a really passionate commitment of mine that we need to talk about it more.
Yeah. What can people see when they turn up on their bikes and say, can I have a look at something?
Well, I mean, for the first thing, the reason that we've hidden out in the Murchison is so that people don't turn up on their bikes and, more importantly, with their phones. I mean, we are out in these places in order to stay away from people, which I think is a shame because exactly that, when you go out there and see it and ask the questions of what are you looking at and what are you trying to find, the best questions come from our young people. And this is a telescope for our next generation. I'm planting a tree under which I will not sit. And so we have to make sure that it is our young people who understand this is for them. And we're creating the opportunities for them to be the ones that find those discoveries. And that's really, I take very seriously here in Australia and in South Africa. And our first young people are coming up through some of these programs and they're so smart. And they're so engaged. And so for me, I'm hoping that the leadership of SKA in two continents is going to look like all of those kids who are out in those communities and on those stations like when I was a girl. And they are. This is the exciting part for me, is the making sure the astronomy of the future represents the people in our communities much better than perhaps we've done so far.
Indeed. Well, the example that comes to mind, which has been pioneered in Oxford by a fellow called Chris Linton, and he, you know, had so many different pictures of certain bodies, too many to analyse, so he outsourced it and the kids helped. And that was an experiment that led perhaps to what you might do in WA.
I hope so. I mean, I think the thing is, I want to make sure that this sort of science is accessible and understandable and in reach. And those things we can do a lot better at. I want it to be a next generation of ferocious little girls who don't think that they're afraid of math and they shouldn't be. And they can see themselves in these places. And I think that's really, for me, a passionate part of the project, which is why I talk about radio astronomy being like K-pop. And in fact, you can explain everything about radio interferometry if you just get a boy band up on stage. And it's melody, it's harmony, it's choreography and synchronization. All of the ingredients that you need for a great K-pop band, it's also the ingredients you need to build a radio interferometer.
There's a thought I've never had. Thank you and congratulations.
Thank you.
The new director of the Square Kilometre Array, Jessica Dempsey, based in Western Australia, I imagine. And did you know, Bell, that the name Jessica came first from Shakespeare in about 1596? That's in The Merchant of Venice. And mine, No Good Boyo, from Dylan Thomas in Under Milk Wood. Where did your name come from, Bell?
Well, Belinda has its roots in many European languages. It just means beautiful. But I've also read that it can mean beautiful serpent. So let's go with that slightly more interesting take.
My Welsh name lapsed, and now I'm merely Robin Williams. But how would you feel about being a moon and then lapsing? Amy Briggs has been looking into this quirk of reality.
Over 30 years after astronomers found the first exoplanet, a planet outside our solar system, they have yet to find the first exomoon. That could be until recently, with researchers suggesting they may have found the first exomoon. Except it's a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, it's like an exomoon, exosatellite, depending on how you want to define things.
That's Kevin Hoy, a PhD student at the Universidad Diego Portales and lead author of the study. He and his colleagues found their exomoon, or exosatellite, some 73 light years away, using the Very Large Telescope in Chile. But the exomoon, or satellite, or whatever you want to call it, doesn't orbit a planet. It orbits a brown dwarf. Brown dwarfs are too massive to be called planets, but not massive enough to burn and shine like a star. That's why they're sometimes called failed stars. Anyway, the brown dwarf that Kevin and his colleagues studied is around 37 times the mass of Jupiter, and it orbits a star called CD352722.
The brown dwarf was discovered by direct imaging in 2011. So we can just take our imaging instruments and look directly at the system, and you can see the star and the brown dwarf clearly separated on the sky.
In order to understand why this is so exciting, we have to look at how Kevin and his colleagues found the satellite orbiting the brown dwarf. And then we'll get back to finding out if it's really an exomoon or not. So just bear with us.
Basically, our method is sensitive to much more massive things than what we would find in the solar system.
In their search for exomoons, astronomers have used the transit method, which is when a telescope is pointed directly at a star waiting for a planet and moon to pass in front of it. The brightness of the star is dimmed ever so slightly, proportional to how big the object is. Now, this works great for planets, but less so for moons. They're just way too small to make a visible difference in the light of a star.
The crazy thing is that for this paper, for this potential discovery of an exomoon, the technique that was used is extremely difficult.
That's Jaime Alvarado Montes, an exomoon researcher from Macquarie University, who was not involved in the study, but is nonetheless very, very excited about it.
So this technique is called radial velocities. That's basically the same technique that was used to discover the first exoplanet back in 1995.
So to describe this method, Jaime asks you to imagine yourself as a telescope here on Earth and that you're face-to-face with him, a giant distant star with a planet orbiting around his head.
Every time the object passes, you're going to have a gravitational pull. So what happens is that the movement of the planet, it pulls my face with gravitation, like it pulls it towards you or away from you. So depending how the planet moves, it could pull me towards you, or if it's passing behind me, it pulls me away from you. So that wobbling of my face going back and forth like this because of the planet, that movement is called, well, we call it, some people like informally call it like the wobbling method, but technically it's called the radial velocity method.
The bigger the wobbles, the bigger the objects. And instead of pointing the telescope at a star, you could point it at the planet itself if you can block the light of the nearby star.
If they're too close together, you can have light from the host star entering the spectrograph instrument.
That's Kevin again.
And then you have like this contamination where you can't necessarily discern, okay, this light is from the star, this light is from the brown dwarf. So the fact that CD35 is so far away that we can have very clean spectra of just the brown dwarf itself made the radial velocity method much simpler. Luckily, we're going to be able to observe it for a very long time because right now it's moving from that closest point of approach out further. And so over time, it actually gets easier and easier to observe.
So I have to ask the question, is this really an exomoon?
I mean, it sounds very easy to define. We would think an exomoon is just a moon that orbits a planet outside the solar system.
That's Jaime again.
In our solar system, the definition of a moon is an object that orbits a planet. In this case, we're finding objects that orbit a brown dwarf. That is not a planet. It's a different thing. So the definition of a moon doesn't apply to it. So technically, it's not an exomoon. So that's why the authors of the paper call it an exosatellite, because it's a satellite, technically not a moon. So in our solar system, all moons are satellites. Its definition is a taxonomy thing.
So if this isn't the first exomoon, and it's proving quite challenging to find the first one, why keep looking? Why are we searching for exomoons?
It shapes certain ideas. For example, you might hear the idea that moons might be more habitable for life than planets tend to be, because moons can have some additional heating effects through tides. The strongest example we have in the solar system is Io. The tidal forces from Jupiter and the other Galilean moons are so strong that you have like a very volcanic object that is very heated internally. And so you can have a lot of that energy without necessarily having to be within an area around the host star. Like, there's not like a strict habitable zone for moons. And whether or not that could support human-like intelligent life is an open question, but at least microbial life could be more possible on moons. It's kind of the frontier of smaller and smaller object discovery. We started with exoplanets around 30-ish years ago, and then you're kind of going into a smaller mass regime. You're looking for smaller signals that are harder to detect. Is it that there's actually a moon here, or is it just that we don't understand the planet system well enough to know that we're actually just misunderstanding it somehow and it's fitting just a normal planet model?
Just as the first exoplanet detection back in the 1990s that transformed the study of planetary systems, now I think this work is just the beginning of a lot of new studies, a lot of new papers, a lot of new research that are going to teach us way more about what we know about moons and how moons form and what a moon is, because whether this particular candidate stands the test of time or not, if we confirm it or we don't confirm it, the methodology and the techniques are there. My take on this paper is not just about the discovery, it's about the technique and what they did, what is amazing and remarkable. And it's just proving how much we can do. We're at a point right now where we can do really interesting things, and not just interesting, but difficult. And there it is, the proof is this paper.
Jaime Alvarado Montes, a planetary scientist from Macquarie University, speaking with Amy Briggs. When it comes to moons in our neck of the solar system, they're pretty rare. Earth has a moon, the moon, and Mars has a pair of moons, which were discovered 150 years ago. But in terms of the inner rocky planets, that's it for moons. Something else that Earth and Mars share are dust storms, and we're just coming into spring, which historically is the time for dust storms in Australia. But as dramatic as they can be, they have nothing on the epic dust storms on the red planet. To find out why, I spoke to Dr. Chelsea Huang, an astronomer at the University of Southern Queensland. I'm guessing to have a dust storm, you need two things: dust and the wind to whip it up and carry it along.
That's right. And the prolonged drought and high wind are perfect ingredients for a large dust storm.
Just off the top of my head, Mars famously has dust storms. Is that kind of where we see dust storms on other planets, either inside our solar system or out?
On top of my mind, Mars is the famous spot to observe a dust storm. Mars is very dusty and very dry. It actually has fairly high wind just because it can be heated quite unevenly on the dry part of Mars and its ice caps. It's quite different from the Earth's dust storms. So on Earth, the dust storms are usually fairly locally, but Mars dust storms can quickly become a global phenomenon once it arises.
So why does that happen?
So one interesting fact about Mars is that its orbit is not exactly a circle. And this actually means Mars receives roughly 40% more solar flux when it's closest to the sun compared to when it's further away from sun. This is actually a different fact for the seasons on Mars on top of the tilted axis. So at its low latitude, it gets a lot of heating from the sun, and this drives wind globally on Mars. And because Mars is also so dry, that then stirs up lots of dust into its atmosphere. It also has a fairly low pressure atmosphere, allows the dust to be suspended in air and goes globally.
Oh, right. Okay. I didn't realize that Mars was so unevenly heated throughout the year. I know that around December, January, on Earth, we're a little bit closer to the sun in our journey around it, which means that, you know, we get more UV during our summer. But Mars, to get 40% extra when it's closer to the sun, that's quite a lot. So it must drive a lot of those temperature extremes and differences that whip up those winds.
And yes, Earth's different heating is actually mostly due to the orbital tilt and much less due to the distance between us and sun changing. So it's quite different from Mars.
How long do Martian dust storms last?
It can actually last weeks and weeks. The one of the most famous one in 2018 lasted so long it killed the rover Opportunity, just because there is so much sand in the atmosphere and not much of the UV gets through the atmosphere, and the solar panel of Opportunity can't recharge, and it lasted so long the rover has to power off completely.
A rover-killing dust storm on Mars.
Yes.
And where else do astronomers see dust storms?
I actually am not aware of other planets with dust storms so far, but we have observed a lot of dust storms on Mars.
Is there the possibility of ever detecting a dust storm or something like it on a planet outside of the solar system?
So to be able to detect a dust storm on a planet outside of the solar system, we first need to image the surface of the planet. Currently, we don't have the capacity yet. However, NASA has planned this $30 billion mission, I might say, called Habitable World Observatory. The goal of this is to actually image the surface of planet outside of the solar system. One can imagine if such a planet exists in the solar neighborhood and can be imaged by the Habitable World Observatory, we can rely on the reflectivity changing of the surface of the planet during and after the dust storm and trying to infer it happened to have a dust storm.
Dr. Chelsea Huang, an astronomer at the University of Southern Queensland.
And now, back on Earth, it's our firestorms, like those in the northern summer we're dreading, so much so that a full page in the Australian Financial Review last week had many of our top scientists asking the federal government to tax gas exports to fund the research we need to tackle this possible Holocaust. One of the signatories is Professor David Bowman, University of Tasmania, who went public during the city's famous Beaker Street Festival.
I think that's fair enough, because we have to really stare into the question of greenhouse gas and decarbonisation. Now, obviously, it's going to take time to decarbonise, but in that transition, there are going to be an incredible amount of adjustments which are going to be very costly, and we've got to make certain that they're based on really high quality research. So at the moment, a lot of the research is very patchy and stuck together and not certain. And just a way of thinking about the sorts of ideas I'm talking about, say these green fire breaks, how much are they going to cost per kilometre, and how many kilometres are we going to need, say, to protect Hobart? Well, it's going to be hundreds of kilometres. We don't know the cost. We need to work that out. And exactly what will these green fire breaks be? Will they be irrigated, thinned? How are they going to be maintained? How are we going to do this? So we're just dipping our toe into this. One of the challenges is finding the money, even to do the thinking, just the calculations and the mapping, the geospatial analysis, let alone the trials and let alone the implementation of doing this. These are really significant challenges. But then just consider for a moment, when you drive down a safe road, are you complaining about the cost of the road? People take those roads as a given because they improve safety and the quality of life. Well, guess what? Because we've got a global wildfire crisis, we have to have a massive amount of investment to adapt as we're going through this decarbonisation process. And it's quite obvious that government budgets are very constrained. And so it's fantastic that research money that we can get, and I love using it to the maximum benefit. But Australia needs a really powerful research group in every state thinking about adaptation to wildfire, to floods, to storms, to all of these things. That's going to cost a ton of money, much more money than is available in the current research ecosystem. So it makes sense to me that if we're exporting a greenhouse gas, which is contributing to climate change, and there's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide, that burning fossil carbon is exacerbating climate extremes and climate disasters, it makes sense. You can say it's a tax, it should be a contribution, an adaptation contribution, so we can get to the pathway where we can have sustainability. Because what's actually really dangerous, if we leave this into this very sort of uncertain, we're just winging it, is that the insurers are actually really smart. And they're looking at this and they're going, at some point, we don't want to be insuring you for these things. And then you have to start thinking through, well, if there's no insurance, who's the insurer? Then does the government become the insurer of last resort? That's going to cost a ton of money too. So it just makes sense that we have to find a revenue stream to do the necessary adaptation work. Decarbonisation is going to take time. We will get there. But in that time, we have to do the adaptation work, and that's going to cost a huge amount of money. And I want that adaptation work to be effective. To be effective, it's got to be based on really high quality research and development. And if you know anything about research funding, R&D funding in Australia, it's just not up to it. This is an enormous extra impost. So we've got to find the money from somewhere.
David Bowman is Professor of Pyrogeography and Fire Science at the University of Tasmania. And next week on The Science Show, he'll give a full assessment of what the fire holocaust in the Northern Hemisphere this summer may mean for us in the South. His analysis is stunning. And Bell, I mentioned the Beaker Street Festival in Hobart just now. Well, one of the speakers at Beaker Street was Professor Lisa Harvey-Smith, also connected to the Square Kilometre Array, and an advisor to the federal government on gender equity in science. And she came to Hobart with a stack of her jolly books on astronomy and physics and made a terrific impact. Very popular.
I hope they are. I mean, I'm very lucky that my books are published all around the world. And I focus on mostly on books for young people, illustrated books for kids about things from black holes and stars and galaxies to my most recent book about quarks and quantum physics for young people. So it's not giving people knowledge necessarily that they remember all of. They don't need to take a test at the end of it. But what they need to do is look at the book and think, there's a new world out there, a new universe that they haven't considered, and that they get that spark and that interest, which they can follow throughout their educational career, maybe through their hobbies, as I did as a young kid, doing astronomy and looking up at the stars, or just pursuing sort of mathematical and scientific concepts and exploring how they might impact the world in positive ways using those skills. And that's really what I'm all about. But people are reading less, and that's something Australia Reads and other organisations are highlighting. So it's really important that, as well as all the tech, we get young people sitting down in a quiet room reading a book and absorbing that. And it really engages your brain in such a wonderful way.
And my sitting down to read for 2 hours is a joy beyond belief. And when I'm on holiday, I go to 3 books a week. It's fantastic. But does it cheer them up? Does it take away some of the worries with which they're consumed?
I think there's research around how reading develops a young brain, and certainly your attention span, but also your creativity. Because even in an illustrated book, there are lots of concepts that you meet, whether they're creative or narrative, where you have to imagine something. And that's a wonderful way to develop a young person's mind and thinking skills. But also we see that technologies that young people use are designed often to be addictive and to reduce attention span, but also reduce critical thinking skills and promote anxiety. So books are very calming. They're good for mental health, the right type of books, certainly. And no one's ever found a book that's particularly bad for young people if it's something that's suitable. And writing is just one of the joys that you can share with other people like that.
What are your last two titles?
So my last title, which is still out in the shops, is Quarks, Sparks and Quantum Mysteries, which is for sort of middle grade, 8 to 12-ish years old. And that's a beautiful illustrated book all about the smallest things inside atoms, how they're used in science and technology, and how they impact the biggest things in our universe, like stars. So stars, for example, run on particle collisions, which create antimatter, and which then create particles and radiation out of those. And that is what makes the sun shine. So we're telling kids there are concepts beyond what they can see every day, but then connect to the real world, the sunshine that we all know. So it's fantastic. And my new title, which is being printed currently, but will be released next year, is called Our Universe, Before, Now and After. So it's about the whole cosmology, the whole of the history of the universe for the last 13.7 billion years, and the future of our universe. What does that look like and how do we know?
That seems to imply that which has been, I always thought, a sort of get out of jail card, the multiverse. In other words, there are other universes there for which there can be no definite evidence, presumably, so it's always lingering there somewhere. Any confirmation of other universes yet?
Well, certainly not. I love theoretical physics because it allows us and certainly it allows theoreticians to delve into the mathematics of the possible and almost plow through logical arguments using maths to go to different conclusions and to test then whether we could see if those conclusions could be tested in the real world. Could they be true? The multiverse for me is one that I've not quite seen a testable hypothesis yet. So I think those things are fun to think about. And again, possibly in the realm of metaphysics or religion, but mainly one day could be testable if we have leaps of discovery and leaps of mathematical ability. Possibly, you know, maybe computers would help us to do that in the future. Who knows?
Going back to those little particles, I first discovered quarks in a book called Finnegan's Wake.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they got the name.
Three quarks for Muster Mark, wasn't it?
Three quarks for Muster Mark, yeah.
Yes, that, I remember that, because that was in Stephen Hawking's book, which was my first foray into quantum physics when I was about 12 years old. I won a competition in the Astronomy Now magazine, and I was actually sent a book, Stephen Hawking's famous Brief History of Time, and that's where I fell in love with quantum physics. Mm.
Of course, Murray Gell-Mann got the Nobel Prize, I think, for quarks. But going back to the question of whether physics is wobbling at the moment or being solid as it used to be, when they wake up CERN and the fast collider, is there any chance that if you accelerate quarks like crazy, you'll get even smaller particles there from which they're made to account for, I don't know, the missing stuff?
Well, there are lots of theories. I mean, there's the sort of standard model of particle physics. And the wonderful thing about that is it's predicted then quarks and the other particles that they make up. And it's predicted a lot of the particles that we don't see in the real world, things like the Higgs boson and other bosons, force particles, gluons, things like this. And a lot of those have been discovered through particle smashing accelerators like CERN, the Large Hadron Collider, and so on. So really, there isn't much predicted beyond that in the particle model that we use. But wouldn't it be wonderful if we did find something? It would actually annoy physicists, I think, because they would, damn it, we've got it wrong. What is this? But, you know, there's been a lot of discovery along the lines of that standard model. And it's really been very much confirmed that the predictions are correct. So it seems to be a well-behaved part of physics, relatively. But who knows? Who knows what we'll find? And that's why we do it. Because if we find something that deviates from the model, the model's wrong, then everything else is on shaky ground. And that's how science moves forward. It's great.
So rule one, don't panic.
Don't panic.
Professor Lisa Harvey-Smith at the marvellous Beaker Street Festival in Hobart just finished. Now, yes, I said now, what about all that connected entanglement? What is real? That's all in a new book from Geraint Lewis, The Shortest History of Reality. And he's with me now. Or is he?
Now, my first argument with you, Geraint, is the word now. I'm with you now, but it's been several seconds since I said now. Does now actually exist?
Oh, now that's a very deep question, and one that physicists and philosophers have argued an awful lot about. Really, things changed at the start of the 1900s when Einstein came on the scene. Before him, time was this nice, steady, regular thing in the universe that everyone agreed on. After him, time becomes more of an experience for one person is different to an experience for another. So what we end up with is that we lose this notion of a universal now, an instant of now across the universe. What that actually means at the very bottom could mean that the past, the present, and the future all exist at the same time, and we're all making our way through this idea of a block universe, or that the universe is unfolding in some sort of really complicated, messy way. But yeah, the notion of now is not a simple one to talk about anymore.
As I look at you, I know I'm not looking at Geraint Lewis. I'm looking at my interpretation of various signals that go through my decrepit eyes into my brain, and there you are, the right way up. A sort of fiction, because most of your atoms are empty space, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, this is what we've discovered over the last 100 years or so, is that, of course, we are made of molecules and atoms. And when we peer inside atoms, we find that the majority of an atom is essentially empty space. So we are made up of all of these little bits bound together that to us has this appearance of some sort of solid body. But then we run into this notion of seeing things with your eyes. And this was one of those questions about, humans have wondered a long time about, what does seeing mean? Do I actually have an objective view of the universe around me? Well, quite clearly I don't, because I know that, firstly, I've already spoken about the fact that I am made of atoms. I also know that this stuff between you and me, the air, is also made of atoms. We're sitting here in this sea of tiny little particles, and you throw light into the mixture as well. So we are essentially constructing a picture in our heads from the signals that are received through our eyes and our ears. But those signals are very imperfect. If you look at the eye, the human eye can only really detect 3 colors, and then your brain, like some sort of master painter, sort of swirls those together to give you the array of colors that you see. Then you end up with deep questions like, is color an objective part of the universe, or is it something that only exists in my head? And one of the things I mentioned in the book is that you talk about a banana. One of the defining characteristics of a nice banana when it's nice and ripe is that it's yellow. Is that yellow a property of the banana, or is it something that I have in my head?
You've got 2 bananas on the cover. Are they B1 and B2?
That is the graphic designer's interpretation of this notion put forward by Plato. So Plato wondered why things are the way they are. And he had this idea that in some realm, and never really specified where this realm was, all things are represented in their perfect form. So out there, there is a perfect banana. And then here on Earth, we all get to have the imperfect sort of projection of that perfection in our day-to-day lives. So you and I and all humans are projections of the perfect human, dogs are projections of the perfect dog, etc. So this just shows that philosophers for thousands of years have wondered about, what is it that I'm made of and what is my part in this universe?
And do I really exist? Now, you mentioned Plato. I didn't follow Plato. I followed someone actually from New Zealand called John Clark, also known as Fred Dagg. And he did an interview with me some time ago about the meaning of life. He did that one because he was supposed to be writing another one, but never got round to it because for him, time was approximate as well. Mm-hmm. And so we just went into the studio and riffed. And we came necessarily to various aspects of whether you or I really exist, and the solipsism of how you can get rid of something that everyone agrees is there, like you or I. And Fred Dagg said, well, his mate Trev said, that's very well, but if you don't exist, you can buy your own round.
Well, you know, existence is, again, one of those things that people have argued about for a long time. And when you say, I exist, what do you mean by that? And I think a lot of people would talk about the thing inside their head, this consciousness, and that you exist almost sort of separate to the physical body that you are. That leads to lots of big questions about where was your consciousness before you were born? Of course, that also leads to the question of where your consciousness goes after you die. So consciousness is one of those really tricky topics. But the physical body, that's easier to talk about. I mean, we know where our physical bodies come from. Generally, we're born relatively small, a few kilos. And we know that we grew out of basically the food consumed by your mother and the air that she breathed. That's where the raw material for making you came from. And you add to that throughout your life. You grow, But this is one of the things that really does my mind in slightly, I tell you the truth, is that, of course, none of your atoms are truly permanent. You recycle yourself. So your skin only lasts for a week or so, your blood cells 120 days, your skeleton gets replaced on a 15-year timescale. So you are not the person you used to be. And that is, for me, a somewhat unsettling kind of picture because...
We're all down the dunny.
Yeah, well, effectively, yes, because we have this feeling of permanence. I have a scar on my finger. I blew the top of my finger off when I was a little kid. And so I've got a nice big scar there. And that scar is not the scar I got when I was a child. It's a memory of that scar because the cells on the surface have died and cells have come up beneath it. They've gone into scar tissue, etc. It's not the same scar. It's an echo of me. And I know that after my death, that my atoms will go back into the great recycling pot and may end up in other people or plants or just stay in the ground. But at the end of the day, we'll be scattered back into the universe, which is kind of cool, I think.
It may be cool, but it's also creepy because, for instance, the mug there presumably used to carry water, the one on your table. Mm-hmm. And that water may have gone through, who knows, how many generations of whoever they were.
Oh, absolutely. We can do these kind of numbers. You can talk about, when you inhale, about how many atoms, molecules of oxygen in your breath were in the last breath of Julius Caesar or William Shakespeare, etc. And there are so many atoms, and we go through so many of them on our day-to-day. And also the liquids in our body, they get constantly recycled. I did my undergraduate degree in the University of London. London is famous for recycling water by pumping sewage down through chalk and then sucking water back up. Water molecules just go through the system. But it's this act of taking stuff in, using it, and then excreting it, and they're all being recycled over and over again. I mean, it's just the way that it's been, not only for life on Earth, but in the universe for billions of years.
One more example, and then I want to ask you a curly question. You mentioned your dear old friend Einstein bending time and linking time and space. This is very hard to conceive. How do you make of all of it?
Well, it's one of those things, you know, I've been immersed in these kind of topics now for 3-4 decades. And so, yes, you go through the shock of trying to understand what the universe is telling you. But physics, a lot of it is about peeling away your preconceptions. We build a view of the universe based upon our day-to-day experiences. We build this view that time is something solid, that it ticks away 1 second per second, tick, tick, tick. And that works really, really well for everything in our day-to-day. Similarly, 1 meter is 1 meter is 1 meter. We're all fine. But what we don't experience on our day-to-day are the extremes. And the extremes are things like really high speeds, right? So speed of light, and really large masses. So masses much bigger than the sun. And when we get to those regimes, then what we find is that the notions that we hold on to with space and time, they have to be relaxed. Otherwise, we lose the battle in trying to understand how these things operate. You can't understand electricity and magnetism until you give up the notion of rigid space and time. You've got to let that go. And at some level, you have to accept that that's just the way that the universe works. You can fight it, but physics is all around making predictions. Your mobile phone, this recording device in front of you, these pieces, they were designed by physicists and engineers. They work by obeying the laws of physics. Yes, it's hard for people to give up. GPS on your phone that tells you where you need to be, that needs to take into account Einstein's maths to tell you where you are. You turn that off, GPS is useless.
There's one problem with your book, and that's this campus, if you like, because ultimately we have to accept that there is a certain truth, even though it's approximate. You know, truth can be 99% there, whereas there is a very, very, very strong political move to deceive us. In other words, misinformation is running rampant. How do you discuss these things and at the same time stay safe so that civilization isn't led up the garden path?
Yeah, this is a tricky one, and this is one that does bother me. I mean, the fact that science and technology underpins all of modern society, and people don't seem to realize that. They sort of see science as being somewhat separate. is worrying. And I think that there has been a bit of a decline in having an educated population, people who understand and appreciate what science does. And a lot of that comes from the top. It comes from our politicians and the way that they approach science. But it also comes from the media. I mean, I don't have to tell you that the number of science documentaries that you would have on TV or you would have on the radio has seen a decline to be replaced by cheaper forms of media. The thing is that even if you do not want to get involved in science yourself, you should want somebody working in science to design that machine that you're going to need when you're in your 70s and you need a cancer removed or you need something within your heart to regulate your heartbeat, etc. These breakthroughs, they don't come from a big tech company deciding, I will come up with a new cure for cancer. They turn to those fundamental physics and saying, oh, so what does this do and what does that do? And of course, at the moment, the buzzword is proton beam therapy, proton beams to kill cancer. The proton discovered by Ernest Rutherford more than 100 years ago now, he wasn't thinking of cancer prevention and diagnosis, etc., when he discovered the proton. But that's what's grown out of 100 years of work with this fundamental research. I think it's part of a modern society. We need fundamental research. We have to realize is that when I talk of reality, that I'm talking really about physical reality. But for us on the day-to-day, we do have a societal reality that we have to deal with. And that's to do with the stuff going on inside our head, our consciousness, our evolution as, you know, slightly evolved apes from the African savannah. I'm sure apes argue about buying rounds of beer exactly the same way.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Now, then, Professor Geraint Lewis's fun book is The Shortest History of Reality and explains the science behind all those uncertainties. In the meantime, please don't use this philosophical fun to undermine real science. Instead, look up the new outfit called Friends of Evidence and see how they fit together. Friends of Evidence is led by former chief scientist Alan Finkel and Liz Finkel. Next week, more from the Beaker Street Science Festival and David Bowman's stunning warnings about fire.
One of the things that the project is exciting is trying to find a pathway for sustainable coexistence with wildfire. And what's really exciting is that the local insurer here in Tasmania, the RACT, have partnered with us and they are now actually taking our research and wanting to see it applied in the field, in the wild. I think it's incredibly satisfying for an applied scientist to see your work being translated and implemented, and they're interested in the fact that they know they have an unsustainable exposure. The risk now for wildfire disasters is extraordinary, and Hobart is a particularly vulnerable place because in 1967 it had a very near miss. It's still, you know, in a costed terms, one of the most severe bushfire disasters. 64 people were killed, but it could have been way, way worse. And now, because of the expansion of Hobart, coupled with climate change, so there's much more housing interspersed with bushland, we're getting more extreme, more frequent wildfire weather conditions, and we have had a run of really bad fire seasons, which have been interesting since the last 10 years, generally on the west of Tassie. We did have a very bad one in 2013, which destroyed the fishing village of Dunalley on the Tasman Peninsula, and that had a fire thunderstorm, the only known fire thunderstorm in Tasmanian history. But I feel our luck is running out. You drive down any major road, any major valley in Tasmania has been impacted by fires. And one of the things that's particularly concerning is that many of these very large fires have been caused by lightning storms, which have seemed to be getting bigger and more frequent. And so it's not just about controlling human behaviour, it's also buckling up, I suppose, to the fact that the climate is now throwing more ignitions into the landscape. The landscapes are getting drier, fire weather is getting worse.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.